Chapter 1. No. Lucy awoke with a gasp and looked around her. Feeble, clouded moonlight flickered through the trees overhead, offering little illumination of her surroundings. As she blinked to regain focus, Lucy became aware that she was naked. Her head was pounding. She folded her legs in close to her chest and wrapped her arms around them, shivering violently as she drew short, sharp breaths. A dull pain began to make itself known from lower down her torso. She lowered her fingers and tentatively prodded. The pain was immediate and severe. She clamped her hand across her mouth to stifle her own yelp as it rang out into the tranquil night. 2 broken ribs. The shivering wasn't helping. Her intercostal muscles went into spasm to keep her core temperature up, tugging at the broken bones as waves of cold rippled through her body. Lucy's hand moved to her head. A swollen lump had formed beneath her thick hair. Through the frigid grogginess and pain, a single thought clawed its way to the front of her mind. Dan. Where was Dan? Lucy's heart rate soared as disordered memories of the attack and derailment flooded back. She tried to recall events methodically, but her brain was fuzzy. Think. Think. The train. The darkness. The creatures. The bearded guy had known about them. Something had scared him enough to throw an old man off the train. But why? Lucy clenched her jaw in a bid to stop the chattering and refocused. Coughing, she thought. Every time the old man coughed, the bearded guy got more aggressive. And the old man had been coughing blood. A memory from the San Francisco Evacuation Center resurfaced. The father with the bloodied leg hadn't been allowed to board the train. Could blood be the link? The thing that these creatures could sense? Lucy frantically checked her body for bleeding. Unable to see in the darkness, she patted herself, feeling and sniffing her limbs for traces. Nearby leaves rustled loudly in the darkness, and she froze once again. Heart pounding, ears pricked in the direction of the sound. She dared not move. Her ears became more attuned to the subtleties of the night, to wind forcing its way through creaking branches and the faint sound of water lapping against a stone. Another dry twig snapped behind her, this time causing her to spin around involuntarily. She immediately recoiled in pain, bent over double as her damaged ribs throbbed. Gasping, she dropped her head to her knees and silently wept. The warm tears rolled down her cold, naked limbs. Where was Dan? When Lucy woke up again, it was day. She didn't remember falling asleep, but found herself lying on her side in a fetal position. Dirt clung to her face and limbs. She raised her head from the ground, seeing her surroundings for the first time. Ahead of her lay forest stretching off as far as she could see, a dense expanse of soaring pines and woodland ferns. Cautiously, she rose to her feet, stooping over slightly as a hand instinctively covered her broken ribs. She lifted her fingers away and examined the damage. Her skin was unbroken, but the dark bruising was already starting to show. Emerging from the forest, she discovered a riverbank, and with it a trail of clothes. Her clothes. Glancing around, she quickly uncovered herself to wring each garment out. The underwear felt horrible as she pulled it on, cold and soggy. Her jeans and top were even worse, saturated with water and mud. So much so that she didn't bother putting them on. They would only cost her more heat. As her eyes fell on the train tracks, flashes of the night came to her, falling from the carriage, tumbling through the darkness, plunging into the water. She remembered washing up on the shore, kicking off her sodden shoes, and clambering onto the side, panting and shivering. She remembered distant screams from the train. She remembered stumbling over the rocks, removing her soaking clothes, and seeking refuge among the trees. As she gazed now at the distant train wreck, a pang of fear struck her. Dan was in there. With arms folded, preserving precious heat in her torso, she made her way onto the tracks. Lucy made slow progress as she tiptoed forwards, avoiding the sharp stones between the coarse railroad ties. Details of the disaster came into focus as she neared the wreckage. The train had derailed at a corner which swept around a large rock face overlooking the river. The track up ahead was bent out of shape, marking the point of derailment. The front engine carriage had careened into the mountainside and now lay parallel to the rock face, while the rest of the double-decker carriages were strewn out behind like a mechanical snake. The second carriage had slightly mounted the engine carriage with the momentum of the collision, meaning that it now protruded upwards, its innards spilling out into the defunct machinery below. Freshly carved ravines in the ground between the buckled track and the wreckage itself showed where the mighty train had skidded to its final resting place. Some carriages were upright, others on their side. One was almost completely inverted, resting at an angle against a neighboring wreck. Items of luggage were dotted all around the site, along with clothing and food, all thrown clear of the train, as well as the first bodies. Lucy hesitated, taking in the grim, contorted angles of the motionless victims. She swallowed, wetting her dry throat, and pushed forwards, looking only for Dan. Amid the debris, one item caught her attention. Face down, sprawled open, its spine elevated off the ground, lay her notepad. She snatched it up, tucking it under her armpit, and continued towards the nearest carriage, the B-list carriage. With trepidation, she crept towards it. A body lay outside the lower deck floor. The bearded executioner. Lucy gasped as she saw the deep gashes where claws had struck his head and neck. Rather than being blood red, the wounds were grayish-purple, and the whole body had a sheen to it. Shuddering, Lucy abandoned the bearded man's body and continued towards the carriage that lay on its side. The doorways of the upper and lower decks were horizontal, side by side, almost 2 meters off the ground. The staircase inside was redundant. To get into either deck, she'd need to climb, but shards of glass lay scattered all around. She put her notepad down and removed the bearded man's shoes, pulling them over her own feet. They felt damp. A scarf lay a few yards away on the grass. She retrieved it and, with some effort, succeeded in tearing it roughly in two, gnawing at the thread to break it. Lucy wrapped half around each hand, forming a thick protective layer over her palms, then approached carriage B. She positioned herself in front of what had been the upper deck's emergency exit. The metal hinges were twisted and torn where the door had been ripped off. Lucy jumped upwards, wrapping her fingertips around the door frame, pulling with all her might and using whatever purchase she could find with the bearded man's shoes. She heaved herself up and over the lip of the threshold. She tumbled forwards, landing awkwardly in the luggage rack below. Extracting herself, Lucy clambered as far left as she could get so that she was flush with the new wall, formerly the roof. The carriage was littered with bodies, luggage, and glass. Both columns of seats stretched ahead, one stacked above the other, protruding from the new right-hand side wall that had been the floor. Limbs hung out of the seat gaps like branches, at odds with the striped tree that protruded through the nearest window frame, its own branches each clinging on by a sinew. Daylight shone in from above as the side windows now formed skylights. A second window was missing further ahead. Lucy made a mental note to expect more glass. Brushing one of the sinewy pine strands aside, she scanned the carnage for signs of Dan. Lucy edged forward, avoiding the broken glass and hoping by some miracle that he wasn't there, that somehow he'd managed to escape like she had. She called out his name as she moved forwards slowly, tentatively peering into each chaotic avenue. As her eyes crawled over the bodies inhabiting each fissure, a shoe sticking out of the row ahead caught her attention. She hurried over, ducking and dodging the stray limbs of other bodies until she reached it. It was him. Her Dan. She looked down at where he lay, perfectly still, his leg stuck up in the air, held there by the body of another man which lay slumped over his. With immense difficulty, she heaved the stranger's corpse away to the side, denials falling from her lips as her eyes remained fixed on her partner. Panting from the effort, she knelt down as best she could and gently reached a hand out to Dan's glistening cheek, hoping for a miracle, praying he would defy her eyes and break out into the trademark smile she loved him for. But as her hand met his damp, pallid skin, she recoiled, shaking her head. Tiny beads of water clung to his pores, to his eyelids, his earlobes, his lips. Lucy straightened up a little, not knowing if she wanted to be near his body or as far from it as possible. She closed her eyes, squeezing them shut and ejecting the well of tears that clung to them, opening them again with vigor as she attempted to wake from the nightmare. Dan's passive gray eyes held her gaze. She couldn't escape the pull of his unresponsive pupils. All the softness and subtlety of his face was gone, replaced by a waxwork, the shell of some new stranger. His head jutted out to the side of his broken neck as if trying to escape the fate of his body. Lucy broke down, collapsing onto him, weeping. Reaching down with trembling hands, she took up her beloved's cold form in her arms. His head lolled freely in her embrace as she pulled him into her chest. Beads of moisture rubbed from his skin onto hers, mingling with the tears that poured from her sealed eyes. Lucy wailed as she clung to him, desperately. She slumped and rocked from side to side, whimpering into his ear, kissing his cheeks, kissing his hair. She reopened her blurry eyes, which swept over his limp body as she rocked. Pausing, she squinted and stared. Something had caught her gaze. There were puncture marks dotted over his body. One by his left collarbone, another on his wrist, another below his ear. She looked around but saw no sign of what might have caused the wounds. Each was circular and less than half an inch in diameter. Cautiously, she reached out towards Dan's limp wrist, his head and torso still slumped into her bosom. The flesh inside the puncture mark was the same purple-gray she'd seen on the bearded man's body. Gingerly, she put her fingers over the hole, only to flinch in response. The apparent cavity was filled with a transparent, sticky liquid. Lucy carefully lifted his head from her bosom. With a scream, she leapt up and fell backwards. Dan's cheek had stuck to her bare skin, peeling away from the rest of his head, which fell to the ground as she recoiled. Frantically, she clawed at her chest, her beloved's flesh disintegrating into transparent flecks like gelatin as she fought to scrape it off. Moaning in horror, she looked back at his crumpled body. Water trickled out of the sunken purple-gray cavity in his face. She scrambled backwards, screaming, brushing into other bodies as she went. More flesh began to cling to her as she tripped over the stranger's macerated corpses. The transparent flecks turned to pulp beneath her scrambling hands, while more water poured from the bodies. Lucy fled from the carriage, stumbling back out onto the grass plateau outside. She vomited, staggering forward in a bid to get away until finally collapsing to her knees. She screamed. An hour or so passed before Lucy felt composed enough to attempt to stand again. She knew she had to move on and seek refuge someplace, but her survival kit was inside the train. She had to go back in. This time she began on the lower deck, crossing over the lieutenant's body at the mouth of the staircase. She wrestled off his flak jacket. The top layer of his flesh peeled away with it, leaving his eviscerated body quietly leaking onto the floor. Retching, Lucy brushed the transparent flecks away. The vest was torn across its front, the work of two claws by the look of it. She checked the pockets, a whistle, a utility knife, a flashlight. It was useful, but it hadn't saved its last owner's life. Holstered to the lieutenant's sunken waist was a handgun, which Lucy removed and strapped around herself, tightening it considerably. She checked the magazine, then the barrel. Plenty of bullets left. Lucy braced herself and returned to the upper deck. She found herself mumbling as she went, doggedly repeating nonsensical words and phrases in a bid to distract her brain from the surroundings. Working as fast as she could, she searched for her belongings within the confines of the carriage entrance, strenuously avoiding allowing her eyes to wander to the far end. "No, no, come on, come on now. Yes, hurry, 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 don't dilly-dally," she babbled, rummaging through the bodies and other detritus, moaning and grunting each time she fought to suppress the image of Dan's mutilated body in her mind. Her hand moved and rested on the gun holster. "You mustn't," she wailed. "You mustn't!"
Later, 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 not now, not here, she insisted.
Finally, she found her backpack. As she was about to leave the carriage, Lucy paused by a dead Asian-looking woman. She pulled off the bearded man's boots, which were already beginning to rub, and held her foot out against the dead woman's soles. They were a match. Undoing the laces, Lucy tugged the boots off, which tore the woman's foot away too. Lucy shut her eyes and turned the boot upside down, shaking hard until all the waxy, liquid flesh had fallen out. She did the same with the other foot, then hopped to the edge of the carriage and hurled both boots and her backpack out into the grass, before climbing out after them. Lucy immediately changed out of the wet underwear into dry clothes from her backpack, still trying desperately to wipe off the transparent flecks clinging to her damp skin. Fully clothed, mostly dry, and now wearing boots that fit, she moved onto the nearest of the destroyed A-list carriages in search of food. The vestibule linking it to carriage B had been severed in the crash, leaving the A carriage's rear doors accessible. Lucy climbed her way into the upper deck compartment. The bodies there bore the same marks of attack, a combination of slashes and punctures. Each one was at a slightly different stage of decay. She recognized Jean's body by her clothes. The kindly woman had died face down, unlike those around her. Forcing herself to ignore the sweating corpses, Lucy scavenged through the A-list luggage. They had some useful items. An occasional flashlight, another pocket knife, different foods. But most of the luggage was academic. Books, diagrams, notes, laptops. She couldn't take them all. She certainly wouldn't understand it all. But these carefully selected items were supposed to be the blueprint for rebuilding America. They were important. The best she could hope for, she reasoned, would be to find help and someday bring people back to this site to salvage the items. Something struck the adjacent deck. Lucy froze. Another bang, closer this time, followed by a scuffling sound. Crouching between two upturned rows of seats, Lucy trained her gun at the empty window frame that formed the new roof of the carriage.
"Christ, don't shoot!" proclaimed the startled woman above, disappearing from view again. "There's another survivor! Guys, over here!" she shouted.
The woman reappeared and lowered herself down into the compartment. She had long, frizzy hair and dark, black skin.
"Are you okay? I heard a scream earlier."
Lucy gawped, not moving.
"I'd be grateful if you could stop pointing that thing at me,"
added the woman, looking at Lucy's gun uneasily. Coming to her senses, Lucy lowered the gun to her side and apologized.
"You don't look so good," said the woman. "You want me to check you out? I'm a doctor. My name's Kristen, by the way."
"Lucy," said Lucy, turning and clambering back towards the exit with an armful of provisions.
"Sorry if we startled you," Kristen continued. "We didn't think anyone else had made it." "Guys!" she called again, projecting her voice toward the broken overhead windows.
As Lucy tumbled out of the rear door, three more survivors appeared outside the carriage, two men and a second woman, all wearing backpacks. The foremost man was in his early 30s, with short, soft-looking dark hair, white skin, and slightly crossed eyes. The second man hung back slightly. He was older and shorter, with glasses, one of which was cracked. He had a thick head of dark brown hair that morphed seamlessly into an equally thick beard and mustache, which were infused with strands of ginger and gray. The woman clutching a map had blonde hair shaped in a bowl cut that curled just below her ears. Her thin cheeks sunk inward, accentuating the natural downturn of her lips.
"This is Josh, Helena, and Toby," said Kristen, panting slightly as she straightened up, having similarly tumbled out of the carriage.
Lucy raised a hand meekly, not sure of the standard etiquette for post-disaster introductions. The severe-looking blonde, clearly Helena, raised a hand, but her expression didn't change.
"Josh,"
said the younger man as he waved. That left Toby at the back, bespectacled and unresponsive, who stared downwards and avoided eye contact.
"How did you survive?" asked Helena.
"I don't know," replied Lucy. "I think I got thrown from the train. I must have fallen in the river because my clothes got soaked. I woke up a mile or so back there."
She turned and pointed to the wooded area down the track.
"How about you guys?"
Lucy asked, refacing the group.
I jumped, said Helena bluntly.
I got out as soon as our carriage stopped rolling, kicked open the door and ran straight for the woods, didn't look back, said Josh.
Lucy nodded and looked at Toby expectantly, but he remained silent.
We don't know how he made it, added Josh. He hasn't spoken yet.
We're going to try and make it by foot to the nearest town, which should be about 20 miles from here according to the map, said Helena. We need to get there before nightfall, before those things come back. So if you're going to come with us, which I suggest you do, then I'd say be prepared to ship out by the time we're done searching the last carriage.
It's the B carriage, said Kristen dismissively.
Yeah, but it's where the soldiers slept, isn't it? So we should check it, replied Helena. She turned back to Lucy.
Unless you checked all their compartments already?
No, mumbled Lucy, flustered, astonished that none of them had mentioned the fact that all their friends and colleagues were dead and liquefying. None of them had even asked if she'd lost anyone. Kristen began climbing into the lower deck of Carriage B. Toby followed her. The pair quickly began chucking useful items out onto the grass. Folding the map back into her utility belt, Helena started cherry-picking the dead soldier's paraphernalia.
Ready to go?
Asked Josh, gesturing with his slightly crossed eyes to the loose pile of rations surrounding Lucy's backpack.
No, I'll do that now, said Lucy, turning away from him and hastily stuffing items into the bag.
Be selective, he said from his position a few paces back. We're going to be carrying these things quite a way.
Lucy nodded, leaning into the backpack and compressing it to pull the zipper shut.
Have you checked her?
Inquired Helena, addressing Kristen as she and Toby returned from Carriage B.
She survived the night, Helena. She's fine, responded the doctor.
We don't leave until she's been checked, asserted Helena, her thin lips flattening further. Kristen rolled her eyes and walked over to Lucy.
Come with me, sweetheart. This won't take a minute, she instructed, leading her away from the others down the side of the carriage.
You can't do that here? Called Helena. We're on a clock, people.
Give the woman a bit of privacy, Helena. Come on, replied Kristen as she led Lucy behind the train. I need to check you're not bleeding anywhere, Kristen said, turning to Lucy once they were alone. Just a precaution, but you can see why. I'm not a creep, by the way. I am an actual doctor, she added, reading Lucy's expression.
You said earlier, it's fine, replied Lucy, turning her back to Kristen and removing her clothes just as she had done in San Francisco. Only this time, the backdrop was the twisted metal spinal column of their wrecked locomotive. Lucy flung the items down on the ground, realizing her resentment at the contingent nature of this group's help.
All right, go, she said, turning to face Kristen. That is some nasty bruising, sweetie, said the doctor, prodding Lucy's broken ribs to gauge the extent of the damage and making Lucy gasp with pain as she did so.
All right, so we've got a couple of broken ribs, muttered Kristen, circling her patient and crouching to inspect Lucy's skin at unannounced intervals.
Lucy became aware of a nagging pain around her left hand. I think I might have sprained my wrist. I fell back on it in the carriage earlier. Today, I mean, not last night, she added.
Okay, which one? Left? Said Kristen, guessing correctly as Lucy nursed the sore area. Hold it out. Can you squeeze around my forearm?
She held out her own arm for Lucy to grip. Lucy squeezed briefly, wincing heavily.
And can you clench and unclench your left hand for me a few times? Continued the doctor.
Uh-huh.
Now try your right.
Okay. And the left again?
Lucy sighed with exasperation. The woman took Lucy's hand and manipulated it in all directions to Lucy's discomfort, comparing it again with her uninjured right.
All right, good, said Kristen, as if it was a routine checkup. Definitely something going on there. Good news is I don't think it's broken. Looks to me like a sprain, like you said. Best we strap that up. The important thing is you're not cut anywhere.
How's it going back there? Called Helena impatiently.
Nearly done, shouted Kristen, as Lucy put her top layers back on.
Wow, you really did all right, didn't you?
Said the doctor, taking a second chance to examine Lucy's legs before they were reclothed.
Aside from the ribs and the wrist, you're pretty much okay, she said, standing up from her invasive crouch. Though I suppose, in a way, that's to be expected. Anything more serious, and I doubt you'd have survived the night. Same goes for all of us. I guess we're the lucky five.
Lucy flinched at the word lucky, but held her tongue.
She's just given you a green light, she counseled herself, controlling her anger. Stay with the other survivors. Kristen might have lost someone, too.
The two emerged from behind the shed and rejoined the others.
All clear, called out Kristen as they approached. Just need to do a quick wrist bandage and then we're good to go. Toby, can you pass me the first aid kit?
The silent man with the artisan beard dutifully swung off his backpack and removed a medical kit, handing it over. Kristen took out a pair of scissors and some bandage, which she wrapped around Lucy's hand, taping the end closed.
Ouch, said Josh, eyeing up Lucy's wrist sympathetically. We good now? Snapped Helena.
All good, said Kristen, smiling, somehow able to retain her good cheer in the face of it all.
Okay, let's move out, replied the blonde navigator, setting off at a pace.
They didn't stop at all for several hours, walking in a loose formation without conversation. Only when they finally broke for lunch did some conversation unfold.
We need to talk about what those things were, began Kristen. Did anyone see them properly?
Kristen looked around the group expectantly, but the others shook their heads, all apart from Toby.
I did,
he said, bringing four sets of astonished eyes directly upon him. He stared at Kristen intently for a moment, inscrutable behind the long brown beard. Eventually he spoke again, placing each word out carefully before his audience.
I only saw too clearly, caught glimpses of others, he said, as his eyes wandered to the horizon.
And? Urged Kristen.
It's not something I want to see again. I can tell you that much,
he replied quietly. He exhaled through the wiry beard and shifted his seated position on the ground. Everyone waited for Kristen to ask him for more details again while he compulsively pulled the grass out from the ground before him.
Imagine, he said, taking a long pause before selecting the right words. A cross between a wolf and a bison. That's pretty much what I saw. Definitely in terms of size, at least.
He shut his eyes and rubbed his temples.
They've got some pretty serious claws on them. I guess that's obvious to everyone, given what we saw on the train. They have more teeth than I've seen in anything on land before. Maybe they appropriated some dragonfish DNA along the way.
He went quiet as he refocused on the grass plucking.
The rib cages were pretty distinctive, too, he continued. There was a sort of mesh covering them. I only caught glimpses of this because they kept moving. It reminded me of the face masks people wear in fencing competitions. But it was translucent. You could see some of their internal organs behind it. What else? I guess they move very fast. My wife.
His voice faltered and he looked down, his hand finally stopping its frantic plucking as he closed his eyes and bit down hard on his bottom lip. Lucy reached across and placed a hand on his arm, her eyes brimming with tears. The stoic bearded man didn't look up or acknowledge her in any way, but nor did he shrug her off. After a respectful pause, Josh, who had been scribbling down Toby's words in a notebook, took up the burden of conversation.
Thank you, Toby. He turned and addressed the group as a whole, holding up his notebook. We should document everything we know about them as we go. Tonight, when we reach the town, we need to start a record of this. How many we think attacked last night, what they did, and what they look like. It's the only way we'll beat them.
He looked around the group. The others nodded quietly.
Every detail, like what Toby shared. Difficult as that will be, we must make a record of. Their teeth, their size, their...
The water. Interrupted Lucy, not looking up, the lasting image of Dan's sunken cheekbone vivid in her mind.
Yes, said Josh. The water.
As the journey continued, Lucy got to know most of the group. She still felt acutely aware of her B status among the others as they talked of their professions and the reasons they'd been on the train, but the others were sensitive enough, or dismissive enough, however you saw it,
not to press her on how she came to be aboard. She began with Kristen, who made for the easiest conversation. A doctor who practiced medicine half the week and researched the other half, Kristen was used to talking to people in clinics, labs, and lecture halls, and it seemed her confidence was matched by a good bedside manner, too. Kristen must have been about 45 from what Lucy could fathom, and she noticed a wedding ring on the woman's left hand.
"I was surprised as you to receive that letter," she admitted. "The fact that they're only evacuating a few thousand people out of the entire West Coast is, frankly, a terrifying indication of the mess we're in, don't you think? Sure, I do research, but I'm not exactly the leading light in the field, because I can only give half my time to it. Which kind of tells me I'm here because all the other candidates on the list had been wiped out by the time they wrote the letters."
"Or maybe they needed one seat to be filled by someone who could count as two people in practice," proffered Lucy.
"That's kind of you to say, dear," replied Kristen. "But the cynic in me can't help but feel I was invited because I'm an uncomplicated guest."
The woman smiled, taking in the vast open expanses of land that stretched out on either side of them.
"My boys would have loved it here," she said, without looking at Lucy. "They were real outdoor types, you know? Here," she added, showing Lucy her phone background.
It was of two grinning young boys in soccer uniforms, one of them missing two front teeth. They looked around 8 and 10.
"My boys," said Kristen, softly, with infinite fondness and longing.
It was the first time Lucy had heard her express anything other than optimism.
"They're beautiful," said Lucy, admiring the photo, trying to ignore the small airplane symbol in the top right corner.
It was an unpleasant reminder of how much had changed in such a short time.
"Thank you," said Kristen, smiling sadly as Lucy handed the phone back. "They died when the pathogen became airborne. On the first day, actually. They were at their father's, otherwise I might have spotted the symptoms quicker. Of course, we never found a treatment that worked for it, so I suppose it wouldn't have made a difference. I just would have liked to have been near them is all."
"I'm so sorry," said Lucy, pressing her hand to Kristen's forearm in sympathy and stopping for a moment. Kristen paused with her, pressing a hand back on top in gratitude. Kristen looked upon the gesture from Lucy with familiarity. Perhaps she saw it a lot working in medicine. Perhaps she was more used to giving comfort than receiving it, thought Lucy.
"What type of medicine do you work in?" Lucy asked.
Kristen laughed once, bitterly. "Surprise, surprise, I'm an immunologist. I study the body's reactions to different pathogens and how our immune system adapts and responds to new threats. But this thing was way too fast for us. Immunologists usually have a good decade or so to study a pathogen, but we got less than a week. Plus, we lost power to the lab on day 2. You remember SARS?"
"Yeah," said Lucy, casting her mind back. "That was years ago, right?"
"Right. It started out in China, and they tried to hush it up, which meant it got onto airplanes and ended up in a whole bunch of other countries. But once we'd figured out we were dealing with an outbreak, a pandemic, the World Health Organization mobilized and everyone managed to isolate and contain the virus. So while we couldn't necessarily cure it during the crisis itself, we managed to eradicate it by stopping its spread.
Same with Ebola.
The point is, you can't contain a pandemic unless everyone's on board, with a coordinated plan right down to the local level. And we've got no satellites, no power, no communications. This new thing spread like wildfire before we knew we'd even been hit as a species."
"How did you know it was airborne?" asked Lucy, trying to show she was keeping up.
"Well, the billions of floating yellow spores were a pretty big clue," laughed Kristen. "And it spread through the population so fast there was no other viable vector. So luckily the government, or National Guard, or City Hall, whoever's actually been running things, figured this out and got masks out to most of the population in time to at least slow its progress. They tried burning the spores, but it didn't work. Maybe it was too late.
Or maybe the spores had disintegrated to a new level we couldn't see.
Lucy nodded, her mind flashing back to the precautions she and Dan had taken. Stealing the hazmat suits, lying next to one another in their individual quarantine zones, unable to kiss or hold one another. She felt a pang of regret. Would she have done it all if she'd known they only had a few days left together?
"Can I ask you a personal question?" said Lucy as they continued to walk.
"Go ahead," replied Kristen.
"Back in San Francisco, before we got on the train, were you..." Kristen looked at her sympathetically.
"Ah, that. Yes, it appears there was quite a price tag for us women to board the train."
"So, have I been sterilized?" asked Lucy, forcing the question out.
"I'm afraid so," said Kristen. "Apparently DC have reported instances of fetal abnormalities linked to the pathogen."
"But I wasn't pregnant."
"It was a preemptive measure, ingesting the contaminated water, gen water, they're calling it. It's...
"I caught the briefing," said Lucy.
"Oh, okay, well, ingestion of gen water seems to cause severe deformation of fetuses and many instances of stillbirth, which is extremely dangerous when we don't have the resources to do ultrasounds on people. If the fetus dies and it's not detected, the mother could die of septicemia, and I think the government wanted everyone on that train to survive."
"But the gen water only affects the fetus?"
"That's what they're saying. Apparently it has no effect on adults, or at least none we've noticed yet. Truth be told, I think they discovered this whole phenomenon on lab rats. Well, possums, to be precise. They breed crazy quick. They didn't have 9 months to test it on enough humans, to be sure."
"But all of that assumes we got pregnant in that time. Or were on our period?" countered Lucy.
"I think they were looking further ahead," replied Kristen. "The species that attacked the train is the latest to emerge, and the most powerful. They're intelligent and coordinated, so it's not just their size and strength that makes them dangerous. Their key method of detection is the scent of blood. If that species continues to be the most successful, they're our greatest threat. And to take them down, we need our best people working on it, and we need those people to go undetected."
"Have the survivors in DC been sterilized too?" said Lucy.
"Anyone recruited to help fight the pandemic? Yes. It's a huge gamble, obviously, and could never have worked on a larger scale. We'd go extinct. I think the idea is that we're running out of time anyway, so by sacrificing a few individuals' fertility to help secure our efforts to eradicate the beasts entirely, then mankind benefits overall. Similarly, they'd argue there's no point in having fertile people who get killed or only birth fetuses doomed to die. If you look at it that way, the disease has already rendered us sterile. This was about buying us the time to fight back."
"What? I'm sorry, but that's total BS," protested Lucy. "The military did that without telling me what the hell they were doing."
"Maybe they were saving your life, Lucy. Maybe you'd have refused if you'd known. Either way, they did it to me, too. So kindly don't shoot the messenger. You asked, I answered."
"Sorry, I'm just processing."
"That's okay, I get it. Look, as I understand it, there are three stages to this. 1, secure DC. 2, win the fight and re-technologize. 3, repopulate using IVF. But stage 3 can never happen if stages 1 or 2 fail. We need to focus on the short term for now, because this is no kind of world to raise a child in. If we do stages 1 and 2, then who knows what the future holds for us. Maybe it holds children. I'm trying not to think that far."
They walked in silence for a few minutes while Lucy digested the information until she was ready to ask again.
"I'm sorry for how I reacted," she said.
"Don't sweat it," replied the doctor. "Compared to some of my patients, you're a human rainbow."
"Last night, before we got attacked, this guy threw an old man off the train,
I think it was because he was bleeding. Is that right? Is that the deal now? If we bleed, those things will find us and kill us?
From a precautionary perspective, I think that should be the default assumption, replied the doctor. So taking precautions would be wise. But from what I heard on the train, these things are still evolving. Their blood detection may change, or that species line might come to an end if something more efficient outcompetes it.
More efficient? At finding us? Said Lucy, wide-eyed.
It doesn't have to be hunting us, necessarily. Personally, I'm holding out for a particularly kick-ass herbivore to evolve that takes out those beast things and then gets on with eating all this damned blue grass. But a girl can dream, chuckled Kristen.
Hey, check this out, called Helena, who had stopped with Josh further ahead. Lucy and Kristen caught up with them.
What is that? Said Lucy, peering down at the sticky spherical globule clinging to the side of the track.
It was around 20 centimeters in diameter and entirely transparent, like an impossibly large and sticky water droplet. Suddenly the sphere began to ripple as great spontaneous pulsations traveled through it.
Whoa, whoa, everyone, stand still,
cried Helena as the group instinctively shuffled backwards.
No one move.
The globule came to rest. Everyone held their breath, eyes fixed on the motionless ball. Another pulsation surged through it, more violent this time, immediately followed by another. The pulsations continued, the gaps in between shrinking until the ball was in a state of constant tremor.
Get back! Cried Helena, suddenly pushing backwards from the quivering orb. I think it's gonna hatch!
Everyone leapt back just as the orb began to change color. It was as if droplets of ink had been flicked into the center. The orangey-red dye started to diffuse around the pulsating sphere, twisting and turning as it mingled with the browns and reds also appearing. Soon the entire orb was a swirling mass of color. With a gushing sound, the globule burst and hundreds of butterflies spilled out, soaring upwards in a spiraling column where the wind began to carry them away. Lucy looked around the group. She and Toby were the only ones to have drawn their handguns. He looked at her but said nothing as he lowered his. Helena and Josh moved backwards toward the vanished globule to inspect the remains. Josh crouched down and photographed the side of the track where a damp patch indicated the site of the sticky orb.
Interesting, commented Helena before stepping away from the rail.
We should move on.
Lucy took a closer look as Helena, Kristen, and Toby set off. At the base of the track were the limp bodies of several butterflies, stuck on their sides. Small droplets covered their wet, crooked wings as they flapped weakly, unable to get off the ground. "Why are those ones damaged?" asked Lucy, peering down at their earthy, autumnal patterns as the creatures, one by one, stopped flapping and fell still.
"Reproduction goes wrong," replied Josh, standing up and putting his phone away. "What's got me stumped is how there were so many of them. I thought fission meant dividing in two."
Lucy fell in step with him as they set off after the others. Maybe whatever it was used to be larger, like a rodent. Then it ingested some butterfly DNA and changed when it re-specialized?
Huh, said Josh. I like that hypothesis. We'll have to test it. What did you say you do again?
Me? Oh, nothing like you guys. Lucy sighed.
I was in the bee carriage.
I see, said Josh, a tone of curiosity in his voice. But you know about the despecialization.
I caught the briefing in A8.
But you also know what cell specialization is and how fission works. There's totally a bit of scientist in you.
Lucy smiled.
I did a year of veterinary college.
A year?
How come? Probed Josh, sticking his thumbs under his backpack straps.
Lucy scrunched up her face.
It's kind of a long story.
Well, that's just as well, he replied, 'cause we're on kind of a long walk.
Okay, said Lucy, gathering her thoughts. I guess it starts back on my dad's farm.
You were a farmer? No way, he cheered, slapping her arm playfully. I didn't have you down as a hick.
I hide it well. People tend not to hire hicks outside of farms. It was also years ago, I should add. I grew up on a farm, but left. Sold it, actually.
You get a good dollar for it?
Enough to cover my dad's medical bills.
Oh, said Josh, staring down the track.
He got cancer when I was 16.
His health insurance wouldn't let him renew once he'd gotten sick, so we had to finance the farm. It paid for his treatment. He went into remission around the time I got a place at Wisconsin U, and he insisted I went. So I did, and I completed my first year. Did pretty well, actually. But in that year, his cancer came back, and he didn't tell me. And I only found out when I got back home for the summer, and he couldn't hide it anymore. He died 4 weeks after that. Suddenly, I didn't want to be a vet anymore. I didn't want to be anything. I just wanted to escape. So I sold our last stake in the farm and used the money to travel. Wound up in San Francisco a year later and decided to stay. So that's me. She swallowed hard as memories of Dan, her father, and the life she'd lost all intermingled painfully and suddenly. "How about you?" she croaked, deciding not to go into her whole mom situation. "I've been in San Francisco my whole life," said Josh proudly. "Great city." Well, was a great city, he added less cheerfully. An awkward silence fell. Lucy's mind gravitated to the aching soles of her feet and the blisters she knew were forming.
"I reckon we're about halfway there now," noted Josh, changing the subject.
"Uh-huh," she grunted, swinging her backpack around and pulling out a cereal bar from one of the side pouches. Josh copied.
"I'm not used to this either," he said, tearing off a chunk of sugared oats as he spoke. "My life usually consists of sitting in front of test tubes and computers for 9 hours a day, then walking to the bus stop, sitting down some more, then sitting on my sofa at home."
"That's a lot of sitting," said Lucy, already halfway through her bar.
"Welcome to lab work," he sighed.
"You're a researcher too, then, like Kristen?"
"I think we're all researchers of some sorts. Toby's a geologist."
"Climatologist," corrected Kristen as Lucy and Josh caught up with her. She and Helena had stopped and were consulting the map. Toby was a few yards ahead, staring into the distance.
"What about you, Lucy? What do you do?" asked Josh, posing the question she'd been dreading all day.
"Walk, apparently," replied Lucy as Helena and Kristen began moving forward again. "We need to pick up the pace if we're going to make it by nightfall," called Helena, marching ahead.
"Tell me about your research," said Lucy, turning the conversation back to Josh.
"I'm a botanist. I know what you're thinking. Very sexy. I get that a lot," he replied.
"You read my mind," quipped Lucy.
"My job is, to advise the government on how to replant America's farms, assuming we make it to D.C. and there's anyone left to advise." Lucy gave him a puzzled look. "There's no one to collect this year's harvest," he elaborated, "and pretty much all of the country's farms are supersized now. I guess you'll know this as well as anyone, being a hick and all."
Lucy's scowl only fueled Josh's grin. "Anyways," he continued, "modern farms are vast because it's efficient, right? Well, only if the machines are working. And with no power and no satellites, all the apps, computers, and machines that watered and fertilized those fields, coupled with the increased temperature owing to the lack of air traffic, I'd say this year's harvest's gonna get fried and die of drought. We've built farms in places that historically never supported serious agriculture, but we got around it by engineering huge irrigation systems. With those systems offline, it makes those farms a write-off. Then there's the issue of labor. There aren't enough workers left alive or coordinated to collect the crops that do grow. Before machines existed, it would have taken half the community working the fields to bring a harvest in, and we're looking thin on the ground for numbers right now. So the crops are going to rot in the ground. And thirdly, there's the new invading species that are taking over. They're already colonizing our farmlands. You saw that pale blue crap from the train window, right? It's spreading, among other things. My happy jobs, then, are to figure out how to achieve an interim harvest, possibly even two, before the satellites are restored. Figure out a pesticide that will work against D4, and also figure out what crops are going to survive a 5-degree temperature hike.
Sounds like a breeze, said Lucy, surveying the endless forest and mountain lining the track. The more carefully she looked, the more she started to notice the pale blue saplings dotted around the forest floor.
Yeah, it'll only take me 20 minutes when I get to D.C., replied Josh. I'll probably just take the rest of the week off. Maybe go to the movies.
Lucy smiled.
We might be able to get around the irrigation issue with cloud seeding, at least, he continued, which doesn't require a satellite, just an airplane and some silver iodine. Or a rocket. Dry ice would work, too.
Lucy's lips formed an inquisitive O shape as she waited for him to elaborate.
Basically, you dump a load of heavy molecules in the sky. We call them condensation nuclei, and they make it rain. Only downside is, it's kind of hard to predict exactly when the rain will start, and where the wind will have taken all those condensed droplets by then.
But other than that, it's foolproof? Lucy replied.
Right, chuckled Josh. Still, we might as well enjoy the fine weather while it lasts.
What do you mean?
Josh shrugged. The climate has a habit of counter-swinging when you do something unexpected to it, like suddenly take out all the clouds made by planes. My bet's that winter's gonna suck pretty bad this year, especially without electricity. So enjoy the warm fall while it lasts. Bay people aren't really used to proper winters, right?
Lucy laughed. We're totally not. Dan always used to joke that...
Lucy stopped laughing, and her smile fell away. Dan was your partner, huh? Asked Josh. Lucy nodded, biting her lip and staring straight ahead.
I'm sorry, he said gently.
No, it's... I'm sure you've lost people, too. Choked Lucy as the track ahead became blurry. Her mind drowned in a sea of guilt. Nausea spread from the pit of her stomach down to her legs, turning her weak and giddy as she tried to balance on the uneven sleepers.
My lace has come undone, she said, stopping abruptly and kneeling to hide her face. I'll catch up with you.
Josh stopped politely.
I said I'll catch up, okay?
Lucy reiterated with an involuntary sniff while staring down and untying her perfectly tied laces. She clenched her teeth, fighting to hold back the tears.
Oh, of course. I'll make sure the others don't rush on, replied Josh, backing away and continuing down the track.
Lucy held her breath until he was at least 10 paces away before the tears began to fall heavily and uncontrollably. She buried her head in her knee and hugged it with all her might, clinging to it desperately. Tears and mucus ran down her trembling calf muscle. He was gone. Her anchor was gone. Should she have left him back there unburied? What would Dan have wanted? What would he say or do now? She wiped her nose with the back of her hand and gripped her ankle firmly. Lucy took a deep breath and exhaled shakily, but slowly. She repeated, another deep breath, another exhalation, continuing until the tears subsided and she had control again. Dan would rationalize the situation. Itemize it, she thought. She hadn't slept properly. She may still have a concussion. 2 of her ribs were broken, and the dull pain was steadily sapping her energy. She hadn't eaten properly in at least 18 hours, and they'd just walked half a marathon with backpacks on. Okay, she reasoned, channeling Dan's voice as best she could. Problems identified. Solutions? Sleep would have to wait, but the carb deficit could be addressed. She took off her backpack and rifled through the side pocket where the snacks were. Taking several more swigs of water, she stuffed the remaining cereal bars into her pockets and pulled the ring back on a tin of fruit, slurping out its juice, then setting off after the others, eating the contents with her hands. Keep moving, she thought. That's what Dan would do.